I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
9:09 now on this foggy Monday morning. Leslie Harris joins us, New Orleans City Councilmember, talk about the latest on the homeless encampment sweep. Good morning, Councilmember Harris. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm okay. I saw you out there on the news, at least, the day of the sweep by the state police. You didn't seem very happy at all.
No, it was very upsetting, especially because we thought that we'd been assured that the sweep would not occur. A lot of the folks out in the Calliope encampment at least had vouchers ready to go to get into housing. And so we had asked the state to hold off on sweeping that particular encampment until Thanksgiving because the city had a plan in place to decommission that encampment, get the folks there housed by Thanksgiving. I thought that that was an agreement that we had with the state, but obviously that didn't happen. Because on Wednesday morning, we woke up to see state police, wildlife and fisheries, and other agencies of the state clearing the encampment.
Yeah, you know, I want to ask you that because you were out there and you saw, I guess, chaos would be an accurate phrase, Leslie?
It was chaos. It was upsetting. I really have never experienced anything like that before. You know, people who were living there, and we have to remember that this is where they're living. So it's almost like someone coming to your house and saying, you gotta move. And while the state kept saying it was only two blocks away, it really was more like a half a mile from the Calliope encampment, which is across from the Greyhound station, down to Home Depot is about a half a mile. And so moving those folks a half a mile, telling them to get their stuff, it was chaos. It was upsetting. And, it was unbelievable, frankly.
Did you get the idea or did you get the feeling that, you know what, we're working on this, we got something in place, why must you come and knock it all over?
Yeah, in fact, we had walked with Commander Hyatt of Troop NOLA on that Monday, and he walked with Nate Fields, and I, Nate is the Director of Homelessness Strategies and Services for the city. And Commander Hyatt even noted that the encampment seemed peaceful, that he didn't see signs of drug use. People actually sweep around their various tents. And, he was going to take it back to the governor that there should be a pause put on the sweep, but that obviously did not happen.
So what is the situation now?
So there was a TRO filed on a temporary restraining order filed on Friday, prohibiting the state from doing any more sweeps. The state was actually going onto city property where there were encampments and telling people that they had to move, which, again, they can do that on state property, but they can't do that on city property. So they were actually going to other areas and transporting people from those other areas into this concentrated encampment, which, again, just creates more chaos because if you put a lot of people into a concentrated area, territory issues break out, people get upset because their stuff is getting moved. And frankly, we had people moving into the neighborhoods, which I told the state was exactly what was going to happen.
Did you get the sense that the state police didn't really want to have to be doing this?
That was my impression. I Commander Hyatt and I have a good relationship. I respect him immensely. I don't think that this is something that they wanted to do, especially at the Calliope encampment, especially because that encampment, again, consisted of about 75 people. And it was really older people just with vouchers in hand waiting for housing. Many of them signed leases that week to get into housing. So my impression was the state police didn't really want to be doing it, but were ordered to do so. And I will note that NOPD did not take part in any of the sweeps that happened.
So for people that don't quite understand about the voucher situation, because I'm getting some text here, Leslie, about what you had in place and how it upset the apple cart. Tell me about that, please.
Sure. Sure. So we Unity Travelers Aid receive vouchers that are housing vouchers. People have to get qualified to get those vouchers, so they have to be qualified. It takes several months to get qualified. They have to have their IDs in place, their Social Security cards. They have to be evaluated medically and psychologically in order to get a housing voucher. Once those vouchers are in hand, then people have to find a place, and we have people to help them to find a place to live, which requires convincing a landlord to take previously homeless people and house them. Again, that can be a process as well. So by moving these folks, a lot of people don't have cell phones. You have to remember that. A lot of people work and leave their stuff to go work. We had that in several instances where people were working and their stuff was moved and they lost everything. So they're losing their IDs, they're losing their vouchers, and then it takes additional outreach to go find that person to get them back in the system and to really get them to trust you again that this isn't going to happen.
Somebody texted and said that New Orleans has more than enough rooms to shelter all the homeless people. I don't think it was. Good.
Address that if you would.
I guess what I'm asking you to do, Leslie, is, and here it goes back to me seeing you out there.
Yeah.
A little sweaty. I don't mean that in an uncomplimentary way. I just mean you're there, right? I mean you're living it. You're feeling it. For people that just drive by, they don't even live in Orleans Parish, they think they know, but they don't, tell them what they're missing, please.
Yeah, my team and I work on the issue of homelessness every single day, Tommy. So this is not like we're flying by night and this is just happening and I'm out there for photo ops. We literally work on it every day. My chief of staff was out there Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday just trying to help people and assist with Nate's team. We do not have enough shelter for our homeless folks. Our low barrier shelter is at capacity. That is run by Odyssey House, and they're doing a great job running our low barrier shelter. There are other shelters like the Salvation Army, like the Mission, like Ozenham Inn, but many of those shelters have requirements that folks are not addicted. Some shelters take people in for the night, but then have them leave during the day so that they're just roaming the streets until the shelter opens back up. So we do not have enough shelter beds, number one. Number two, we do not have enough housing for our folks. That's why the Housing Trust Fund, I've been, you know, talking to you about that and talking to voters about it, is so critical so that we can get additional apartments built for people to live in. And the other misconception is that a lot of people on the street are drug addicted, are mentally impaired. And in some cases, that's true. But we also have a lot of people, one of my neighbors included, who lost their housing, had no money, and had no place to go. And so, again, we see people who are leaving their tents, going to work in fast food restaurants, and then coming back to sleep at night in their tents just to make it through on a day-to-day basis. And so the misconception of who is living in the encampments is really great. And, you know, I'm always able to answer questions to anyone who wants to sit with me and talk about it.
Not great in a good way. Great as in volume.
Yeah.
The misconception.
Great misconception about it. And again, if anybody wants to walk the encampments with me and my team, I'm happy to do that. I'm happy to introduce them to folks and they can hear their stories firsthand.
I think more people need to do that. Let me ask you about people going to work that are homeless, because that defies everything that some people in their, I don't want to insult anybody here, but real ignorance of the situation and trying to think that there's a simple solution to a complex problem. And, you know, I don't know if they go to church or not, but I know when I was growing up, they used to sing the song, "Whatsoever you do to the least of my brethren, that you do unto me." And I think, you know, I'm not a religious zealot here, Leslie, or anything, but I do think at some point you got to realize that they're just fellow human beings, right? So if you want to take a second and clear up some of the misconceptions or misperceptions that these are not people that are just, you know, bums or anything, however you want to say it.
Yeah, you know, we had an incident I guess it was last year, where a woman had driven to New Orleans with her disabled father, her son, for a job, and that job fell through, and her car broke down. It sounds like a country music song, but this is reality. And she, her disabled father, and her son were living in an encampment. All it took literally was getting her car fixed and her a gas card to get her back to where she needed to be. This wasn't somebody, again, who was drug addicted or mentally impaired. It was just someone who fell on hard times and needed simple problem solving in order to get themselves back to where they needed to be. That's what the outreach workers do on a daily basis. They go out into the encampments, they problem solve with people. Sometimes it is just a matter of getting a bus ticket. Grace at the Green Light does a great job at that, of getting people bus tickets back to family members who can house them back out of town, because a lot of people come to New Orleans looking for jobs, can't find housing, and then guess what? They end up sleeping outside or sleeping in their cars.
As the father of a daughter, I like successful, confident, strong women, because I think you're a good role model for people like that. And I think that is exactly what you are. And you made partner in a law firm, then you decided to run for city council because you, I don't have to puff you up. People know about you. But I guess the point I'm making is, Leslie, why do you choose to do this when the easiest thing in the world would be to just, you know, tackle something else?
Because I care about people, because my team cares deeply about the city. You can see the outreach workers, just, they were devastated to see what happened. And I sound emotional because I am. It was really, really hard to see Tommy.
Thank you for your efforts. I'm sorry. If is there anything anybody can do to help? What can people do if they want to get involved, if they want to find out more about this? Like you said, you'd be glad to walk with them and show them what the real problems are.
Absolutely. I'm happy to walk with anybody or sit and have a coffee with them and talk about it. But they can visit Home for Good New Orleans, homeforgoodneworleans.org. It's a website where you can actually donate to help folks get housed. You can also read up on all of the efforts. We have gotten housed since the beginning of this year, almost 600 people. So 600 people housed and off the streets. We will continue this effort despite whatever the state does. And we are having a meeting with the state tomorrow to talk about how this can be prevented in the future. So I will be there and I will continue to advocate for the least of us.
Thank you, Leslie. I appreciate your time and your efforts. God bless you.
Thank you, Tommy. Bye.
Leslie Harris, New Orleans City Council Member, 922. Quick break. We come back. We'll talk to Ramon Antonio Vargas. Third-party expert issued a report on how to settle a highly contentious New Orleans church bankruptcy case. We'll talk about it when we come back on WWL.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser-told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
927, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by our friend Ramon Antonio Vargas, editor and reporter at The Guardian. Latest on the Archdiocesan bankruptcy case, which continues to go on and on and on. And you know, it's like, I'm not trying to be flip. First of all, good morning, Ramon. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for having me, as always.
And you know, I complimented you guys, you and David Hammer, on Twitter about the work that you do. And I mean that sincerely, because if not for y'all, we wouldn't know about any of this. Nor, I don't think, would the victims have the voice that they have in all of this. So I think you're doing good work. I don't mean to be flippant about this, but there's a Seinfeld episode where they say, you know, tell Kramer, you kept making the stops, and he says they kept ringing the bell. And the only reason I bring that up is we're going to talk about this again. Yes, because it hasn't been settled yet. With that being said, give me some background, some context for what we're about to talk about here with this highly contentious church bankruptcy case, Ramon.
Sure. I mean, right now where it stands, right, is the church, as part of the fallout of the decades-old clergy molestation crisis, scandal, what have you, filed for, you know, bankruptcy in 2020. It was only until a few months ago, really last month, that the church and attorneys representing about 500 clergy abuse claimants locally filed sort of competing plans on how to settle their differences. They're, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars apart. And so the judge in charge of the case, Meredith Grable, brought on a what is known as a bankruptcy restructuring professional by the name of Mo Meji to, you know, assess the plans and sort of, you know, assess the viability of them. And essentially what he ended up coming up with is that, yes, the two sides can find a resolution, and to sort of coax both sides to work toward a resolution, as, you know, it's been more than 4 years, costs have soared to more than $40 million in professional fees alone, mostly to the church's attorneys and to the church's professional advisors. Basically, his report that he issued last week suggested that all professionals involved in the matter have their pay deferred for 3 months. And if in those 3 months, during the interim, there is no settlement, to then advise the judge to then have a special appoint yet someone else, especially. Yes, go ahead.
Let me slow down for a second because I'm trying to understand this. Who's going to get deferred for what?
So obviously there's been a lot of attorneys on all sides and advisors, et cetera. So everyone, nobody gets paid for 3 months, right?
But to be clear, the victim's attorneys have not seen a dime, have they?
That's correct. The victim's attorneys, at least the ones that are representing, this is an important distinction, right? The ones who are representing them in connection with the abuse claims, right? They obviously, that is all on contingency, right? And so those people get paid at the end after the victims get their cut as well of any sort of settlement that they get. There are some attorneys who represent them collectively in the bankruptcy process. And obviously they have been billing into the process as well.
Who pays? So, I'm just curious, Ramon, billing whom? Who pays for
the church?
That?
I mean, all of this comes out of the church, right?
Okay.
And all this comes out of the church. And so
and that number's, you know, up north of $40 million, right? From an original estimate of $7.5 million?
Yeah, and I mean that's an old figure at this point, right?
Okay.
And it's updated every now and then. So yeah, I mean, you're talking about tens of millions of dollars that have already been spent. And so the point is that if you defer, the idea is like, okay, like nobody gets paid for 3 months. If it settles, those 3 months, like eventually they will get paid those 3 months, right? But for now, it's like for these next 3 months, defer payment, and then try to work toward a settlement, because, you know, both having the opinion of this report is everyone that it is possible for both sides to reach a settlement, right? We've seen it all over the country. Other places other churches who filed for bankruptcy after New Orleans did settled before New Orleans did, right? And if failing that, I guess the suggestion is to have a special examiner investigate all of the archdiocese's assets, cash, real estate, et cetera, and then make a call about whether the church filed for Chapter 11 protection, quote, in good faith. Now, why, you know, one question that kind of remains unanswered is that apparently, you know, as clear as ever, we're 4 years into this process and still nobody seems to have a really good idea about how much cash and real estate their church actually has on hand. And still, you know, apparently this report is asking the question about, you know, maybe there's a chance that they didn't file this quote in good faith, meaning that they weren't really bankrupt. But that's kind of where things stand right now. As far as this case goes, the issue is that, I mean, I think there's been a hearing scheduled for next month, right? I think November 21st. So that's another month of no activity, right? There's kind of like at least three more months to go. We still need to see if the judge adopts this this report. But considering that she spent $350,000 of the church's money, and that's money that is being taken out of the pie that is sort of kind of being divvied up for poor people who are owed by the church, including abuse victims. There's no indication that she won't adopt this report and its suggestions. But so, you know, still a few more months to go, at least. And that's where things stand.
So I'm going to get back to the pie after the break. But I guess the first question is, Well, let me take the break first, and we'll get back to this other question as well, which is about, is this just about cash flow? Because if you're just going to defer payments, I don't understand what we're going to accomplish here, because they're going to continue to bill. They'll just get paid after 3 months. We'll try to sort it out when we come back. I guess, bottom line, what is this going to speed up, or is it going to speed anything up? 9:35, 25 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 9:40, 20 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking with Ramon Antonio Vargas, editor and reporter of The Guardian, about a third-party expert issued a report on how to settle a highly contentious New Orleans church bankruptcy case. He and David Hammer have been reporting on this for how long, Ramon?
Years. I mean, on the bankruptcy since it was filed. Yeah. May 2020.
May of 21?
May of 2020.
20. So let me talk about this pie, first of all. You said this piece of the pie. The pie consists of money that the Archdiocese of the church has left over after bankruptcy, or do we know how big that pie is?
So, again, I mean, one of the things that the suggestion that the report makes, right, is to, if we don't settle in the next 3 months, and this was last week, right, so if we don't settle between now and, what, January, since January, find out, like, how much cash and real estate the Archdiocese actually has, right? And so you asked a question before, which was, you know, what did this accomplish? How did this move the needle forward, right? I mean, I think that there are a lot of people involved in this bankruptcy that have the exact same question, which is, you know, it's, you know, this was filed in May 2020, it's October of 2024, you know, and only now are we coming up with the suggestion of, like, let's find out, like, how much in cash and real estate the Archdiocese has, to see, like, how much it can afford to, and obviously the plan, right, and this is, again, like, I think nobody has really, like, suggested to compel the church to put up a settlement that would, you know, basically take out the Catholic Church in New Orleans, right? I mean, the idea is to make the victims whole while allowing the church to kind of continue its core mission, which is, again, what the report suggested, you know, should be done. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that there's a real level of frustration as far as what did this do other than just kind of put a pause on. It took two months for the report to be prepared at a cost of $350,000. And then, and, you know, we're talking about another 3 months to kind of see if it can be settled, right? So that's about 5 months of just kind of stretching the case out, which is, you know, frustrating for people who have, you know, been in this process for 4 years. And certainly you can see other, you know, dioceses elsewhere. You have an idea of kind of what the going rate, I hate to use that term, but you kind of have an idea of what the going rate is per abuse claim, right? The church right now is proposing $125,000 per claim with no help from insurance, right? It's just the church and you know, the archdiocese, schools, you know, other ministries. On the other side, the victims who are proposing, you know, a much higher number at $2 million per claim, the bulk of which would come from insurance, right? Not the church, not its schools. So under their plan, they would be called on to provide as well. But you have an idea, right? Los Angeles just settled about $650,000. The Catholic Church in Los Angeles paid about $650,000 per abuse claim to settle a bankruptcy out there. And on Long Island in New York, you know, the settlement was about $609,000 per claim. So that kind of gives you an idea of the range that you're kind of like trying to work toward, as you've got a very low offer from the church, you've got a very high offer from the victims. So, I mean, I think that there's some frustration as to, like, you know, we paid $350,000 for, you know, kind of very suggestions that probably could have been made very early in the process at, you know, before all this money had been spent. And also, I mean, in the last program, look, I don't want to eat up like the last few minutes that we have talking about this, but obviously there was some skepticism about the author of this report.
No, I think that's important. I wanted you to go into that. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, for, you know, for an unrelated reason, and I can go into the details that you want, but
do,
I mean,
that, please.
In short, I mean, you know, this was produced by a bankruptcy expert who, for his conduct in a separate case, you know, has had the FBI looking into, you know, his work and how he behaved in a separate case in Houston. Now, we can go into, you know, it very quickly, you kind of go down this rabbit hole about what he did and whatnot. But there was some skepticism about, you know, about what you would kind of expect to get. In the end, I think the report turned out to be kind of very vanilla suggestions of kind of both sides are responsible for the delays. Obviously, the victims' attorneys are and really the survivors are very frustrated at that sort of kind of both sides in tone, where they kind of look at it. But certainly the church will feel validated that, you know, they've also said that, you know, we've been subjected to, you know, we've been subjected to sort of like pressure to settle. Whereas really the victim side is like, well, you know, if you feel pressure to settle because, you know, our side has exposed evidence of crimes, in that, you know, are contained in information that was sealed off in the bankruptcy that got out to the public, through no small part because of David Hammer and I reporting on it. And then to the point that, you know, there is a state police investigation into a lot of those allegations now, that is investigating whether the church ran, and this is straight from court documents, right? This isn't some like conspiracy theory, that, you know, whether the, you know, church ran a child sex trafficking ring responsible for, quote, widespread sexual abuse of minors dating back decades that was, quote, covered up and not reported to law enforcement. I think some of the frustration is that, like, you know, you've got one side, the church, saying, you know, those are, you know, we've been subjected to like high pressure tactics, and kind of like strong arm tactics to get us to settle. And, you know, victims saying like, we've simply like asked for investigation into evidence of crimes of child rape. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where things stand. I think in the end, it seemed, the takeaway is that, you know, it's going to be, barring a settlement, it'll be at least until January, until the case kind of progresses meaningfully.
Somebody texted in and said, this is exhausting, very difficult to comprehend. And to that, I would say, you're damn right it's exhausting and very difficult to comprehend. And you can only imagine how exasperating it is for the victims. So let me try to get through a little bit of this. Do when it comes to the pie, if you will, of the church's yeah. assets that we're talking about, right, of what they have, what the amount that they have from which to pay claims. Mm-hmm. Where does insurance factor into that? Because if they have insurance for this, why is the church fighting it, or is an insurance a party to the bankruptcy?
No, I mean, look, there's insurers who are definitely involved, and in other settlements, you've seen insurers put up part of the settlement, right? I think that what the church's plan has conveyed is basically like, you guys figure it out with the insurance companies. This is kind of what we can put up. You know, the victim side is arguing, you know, we want a little more from you, you know, the church, and then, and yeah, I mean, we expect quite a bit from your insurers. I mean, as far as, you know, what's difficult is that, like, we've reported this, right, that there have been offers to buy something like Christopher Homes, which is, like, the housing ministry, and it's got a bunch of housing complex, you know, a bunch of, like, housing units, that, you know, multi-million dollar offer, and, you know, including one that would be contingent on that money being used to fund a settlement with victims, right? And that just hasn't been accepted, right? It just hasn't been acted on. And so to the extent you can sit here and, you know, certainly like it can be negotiated whether, you know, I understand that the church is in a position where like, we don't want to give anything up that affects our ability to carry out our mission. But could like the church continue to be the church if it sells like some of its like housing ministries, right? I think that's a question we've been waiting to get the answer to.
Well, yeah, but again, you're talking about the Archdiocese of New Orleans and assets that they have, but and again, this is a nonprofit, not a corporate structure, but the Catholic Church has God knows how much assets if they want to do the right thing, that they could still pursue their mission in the Archdiocese of New Orleans and still compensate the victims without yes. paying a lawyer for, or the lawyers involved in this $40 million, right? I mean, that is just crazy. This is just nuts to me, Ramon. I'm trying to make sense of it. And then when you talk about the latest report, they spent another $350,000 for Mo Meji to say, all right, tell you what we're going to do. Nobody gets paid for 3 months. Y'all work it out. So you mean we're not going to get paid at all? No, no, you'll still get paid. And that's why I use the phrase cash flow, because I don't understand where the incentive comes in other than from a cash flow standpoint. Am I missing something here or not? What did they get for $350,000? What did Mo come up with?
I mean, at this, I think that, you know, you have one side of the bankruptcy saying not much. I mean, I think that at this stage you have, I think universally the tide has turned as far as like this has gone on too long and it has cost too much money, right? I think that wasn't necessarily true at this time last year, but that certainly has changed as this has dragged out, especially when some of the details as far as like exactly, you know, who's been billing most of it, and we've discussed that on this program. But as far as like what we came up with, what the report came up with, I mean, I think it's a fair criticism to say that it probably didn't come up with much other than it seems like finally the suggestion has been made, like, let's find out exactly how much in assets the church has, right? And in terms of exactly how much land that's worth, what it can be compelled to divest in. And certainly the church has sold some stuff. But again, I mean, I think that like having an examiner kind of come in and put, I discussed the offer a little while ago for the housing ministry, right? That there are offers that they're sitting on to sell that.
But what I'm saying is it's a false comparison to say that, because here's what I think the Archdiocese is trying to say, okay, we'd like to provide housing with Christopher Homes, but we can't because we're going to have to sell it to pay these bankruptcy victims, these sex abuse victims, in essence, making them the bad guys, when in fact the Catholic Church itself has God knows how much in assets where they could easily compensate the victims of sexual predators that the church itself screwed up the handling of and still maintain their mission, right? Their mission.
That is all. That is all true. I'm going to cut you off. That's all true. It's just that, like, again, like, it seems like what this report made clear is that, like, still the court does not have a command on how much assets it has, right? I think that the idea is a true examination will probably reveal that it has more than it has indicated that it has, and so the idea being that that's a little bit of pressure to try to see if you can get to try to settle before somebody comes in and reviews and once you get someone in there, then you start, you open the door to reviewing the appropriateness of some of the fees that have been billed, right? And, in other cases we've seen, in other church bankruptcies, we've seen excessive fees get clawed back. So, once you get an examiner in there, does their scope open to not only getting, a true breakdown of how much the debtor has, in this case the church, but then does that inquiry then open into, okay, well, let's look at some of these fees that have been paid out. And in other cases when that's happened, they've clawed some of that back. So,
and although a nonprofit and a church, it has the same protections as does a Fortune 500 company. That's accurate?
Well, I mean, even in some cases, even more, right? I mean, I think that the church is uniquely positioned in that they get a lot of consideration. I mean, one of the questions is, like, should financial control be taken away from the archbishop and his appointed man who is running, the bankruptcy? And, I mean, their argument is basically, like, you can't take that away from us because that would violate the Constitution's separation of church and state, right? And that's something that a Fortune 500 company could not argue. So, no, I mean, it is a relatively comfortable position to be in Chapter 11 bankruptcy for an organization like the Roman Catholic Church.
And forget what's right or wrong. Thank you, Ramon. I appreciate your time. We'll talk to you again soon. We'll find out what Newell Norman's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events. Major elections, world wars, scientific breakthroughs. But we also bring you into the smaller, behind-the-scenes stories. the unsung heroes, secret meetings, even personal grudges that changed the course of history. Listen to and follow History This Week, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with the History Channel. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.